Knew what? That John had been married to my mother? Sure, I suppose it came up when he first volunteered at the store, but I don't even remember talking about it.
What was he like back then? Harry asked. Did you live with him?
Just for a little while. He was the same. He loved to work, was friendly to everyone. Why are you asking all these questions? Harry rubbed at one of his eyes where a nerve had been fluttering. A few hours ago, he'd known for a fact that it had been John standing out in front of the motel room, keeping an eye on Caitlin. Now, he wasn't so sure. He opened his mouth to ask another question, then stopped. Suddenly, he didn't want Alice to know about his suspicions. Why had he even had them? The flapping suit jacket? It wasn't enough.
No reason, Harry said.
You don't think he... Alice began, just as Dr. Roy entered the room.
Good morning, the doctor said, as Alice stood.
How are you feeling this morning, Harry?
Better?
I'm fine, he said.
I'll just step outside, Alice said, and moved quickly to the door. Dr. Roy perched on one of the plastic chairs next to Harry's bed and asked him how he had slept.
Except for being woken up every hour, fine.
Are you sleepy now?
No, I'm just ready to get out of here.
Yes, I totally understand.
She pushed a dark strand of hair back behind an ear and looked down at the clipboard in her lap.
I need to ask you some questions first, okay? Then you're free to go.
Harry nodded.
I'm going to give you four words and I want you to repeat them back to me in the same order as I say them, okay?
Sure.
Car, telephone, apple, and shoe.
Harry repeated the words.
Good. Now can you tell me the months of the year, but backward?
He did that as well, as Dr. Roy scribbled onto a sheet.
Very good, she said. Now tell me about how your head feels. Last night you complained of a headache. Do you remember that? And said that the pain was a 6 out of 10. Do you still have a headache this morning?
No, not really,
Harry said, even though his temples still felt pinched by a dull, throbbing pain.
Not at all?
Maybe a slight headache.
And how would you characterize the pain of that headache on a scale of 1 to 10?
A 1, Harry said.
She asked him a few more questions about how he was feeling, then used an instrument with a light to track the movement of his eyes.
You seem good, Harry, she said,
her fingers gently touching the area around his scalp where he'd received the blow.
I have one more question. Can you tell me the four words I said to you when I first came in here?
For a brief moment, Harry blanked, but then it came back to him and he quickly said,
car, telephone, apple, shoe.
Good.
She smiled, then looked at her watch.
I'll send the nurse round with your discharge papers. Who's taking you home, do you know?
My stepmother, I guess.
Okay, sounds good.
After the doctor left, Harry kept his eyes on the door, waiting either for his discharge or for Alice to return. He was eager to leave, frantic, almost, anxious to check in with Caitlin, make sure she was okay. He'd tell her that he felt sure he knew who the man watching her had been. He hadn't decided yet whether to tell Detective Dixon. What if he was wrong? What would John think, then? He must have dozed off, because he woke to the sound of the nurse's voice as he came into the room holding a clipboard. After being discharged by the nurse, Harry dressed in the clothes he'd been wearing the night before and went to look for Alice. She wasn't in the waiting room, and a nurse told him she'd gone home to change and that she'd be back soon. He walked outside to the emergency room entrance and stood under the awning. He tried both Alice's cell phone and the landline at the house, but she didn't pick up. He tried Caitlin as well and got no answer. He tried to figure out what to do next. It was too far to walk. He could call a cab, he told himself, have it take him back to the house, or he could call Detective Dixon, tell him he needed a ride. Before he decided, a rust-pocked yellow cab pulled up to the curb, and a wiry driver in a jean jacket leapt out to open the door for an obese passenger, a woman carrying her own oxygen tank who needed help getting through the hospital's sliding doors. When the driver returned, Harry asked him for a ride.
I have another fare in 10 minutes. How far do you need to go?
Harry gave him the address of Gray Lady, and the driver agreed. The car was stuffy, smelling of permanent body odor and the distant memory of cigarette smoke. Harry cracked the window as the driver barreled through the quiet back streets of Kennewick. The day was overcast, but warm. The driver dropped Harry off at the top of the driveway, speeding off as soon as Harry paid. Harry squinted toward the house, wishing he had sunglasses. It was the type of overcast sky that was still bright, a harsh whiteness suffusing everything. He pressed his fingers to his closed eyelids, and bright red spots swam in his vision. When he felt better, he walked to the front door, checking his jacket pocket, happy to find his keys there. Alice's car wasn't in the driveway. It was strange. If she'd been heading back to the hospital, he would have passed her in the taxi. Where else would she be? Maybe she'd gone to see John? Clearly, they were much closer than he'd ever realized. He was still shocked by the revelation that John had been Alice's stepfather. He entered the house, shouted, "Hello," into its interior just to make sure he was alone, then walked to the kitchen, hoping to find coffee. He was desperate for caffeine. There was a quarter of a pot left, and he poured it over ice and took a long, bitter swallow. He thought some more about Alice and John. What if they were still close? What if John had killed Bill and Grace as a favor for Alice, as revenge for their affair? It was ludicrous, but possible. Both Bill and Grace were dead, and the only one with a solid motive to kill them was Alice, the spurned wife. Alice had acted as though John and she weren't close at all, but what if they were? Harry remembered a few days earlier when he'd been looking through Alice's desk and found the old photograph in her passport, a photograph of her and an older man. He put down his coffee and walked to Alice's office. He found the photograph again in Alice's desk drawer. A young Alice with an older man, his arm around her. Harry studied the man. It definitely could have been John, even though the man in the photograph had a full head of hair and was clean-shaven. But he had the same strong, slim build, the same slope of the shoulders. It was impossible to tell for sure. Harry riffled through the papers in the desk drawer, looking for another photograph. He didn't find anything, but he did find a post-it note stuck to the wooden bottom of the drawer. Handwritten on the note was the phrase, "Miss Mossy Pants." No caps, words all strung together. It had to be Alice's password. Harry flipped open the laptop on the desk and hit the power button. Then, while it was booting up, he had another idea. He opened the Phone Finder app on his phone. It allowed you to find out where someone was based on the GPS location of their cell phone, but you needed their password to do it. He punched Alice's phone number into the app, then entered her password. A map appeared, and an icon of a phone. She was near Kennewick Beach, just off Micmac Road, on Scituate Avenue. Harry could picture the address. A 3-story condo development. The same one his father had pointed out to him. Chapter 31. Now. Alice hadn't been to Jake's condo on Kennewick Beach for over a decade. She'd passed it many times, of course, in the car or while walking along Kennewick Beach, but since she'd been married to Bill, she barely even noticed it anymore. It was a relic from the past, in the way her mother was long gone, and in the way that Jake, as she used to know him, was also gone. But while she'd been waiting at the hospital, she'd gotten a text from Jake asking her to come right away. She had a bad feeling, especially since Harry had been asking all those questions. Had it been Jake that Harry had seen in front of the motel? Nothing would shock her right now. And now he wanted her to come to his condo, something he'd never asked. It could only be bad news. Alice had thought it possible, after hearing that her husband had died, that Jake had been responsible. They'd had that conversation about Bill and the girl down in New York, and she'd seen something in Jake's eyes, that loyalty he'd always had, that told her he might do something about it. If he had done it, he'd done a good job of making it look like an accident. But then Jake had probably gone and killed Bill's girlfriend who'd come up from New York for the funeral. That was a stupid move, drawing more attention to Bill's death and probably drawing attention away from Annie and Lou Callahan. And then she'd gotten the call late last night about Harry, and she'd wondered if Jake had something to do with that as well. He was spinning out of control. She'd immediately called him, left him a message telling him to meet her at the hospital, and he had, though she'd yet to be able to truly talk with him. But she'd seen him. He looked terrible when she spotted him in the entranceway, like he hadn't slept in days. His eyes were bloodshot, and he even smelled bad, like something had gone rotten inside of him. She pulled in front of his unit in the condo parking lot, and stared up at the faded gray wood of the four-unit development and the flat white sky above it. "This is where my mother died," she thought, surprising herself. Usually, when she thought of the condo, she thought of the beautiful years she had lived here with Jake. It had been one of the happiest times of her life, even though a part of her now knew that it had all been lies, like so much else in her life. She stepped out onto the parking lot, smoothed her skirt down along her thighs, and locked the car behind her. She walked across the asphalt, gritty with sand, then up the exterior stairway to Jake's door. She rang the bell and listened to the familiar bong from inside the condo. The door opened. Jake was standing there, his suit jacket rumpled, his eyes puffy. His mouth looked slack, hanging open slightly, and the white hairs of his mustache had grown over his upper lip. "Jake," she said.
"I screwed up," he said. "I screwed up everything."
She stepped inside the condo, and Jake shut the door behind her. She walked into the living room, dark because the curtains were closed, but what she could see looked grimy and unkempt. And it was too warm, the windows yet to be opened since winter. "What did you do?" she asked. Jake scratched at his scalp. The sides of his lips were crusted in white, like he needed to drink a glass of water.
"Did he see me?"
"Did whom see you?" Alice asked. She decided if Jake was suddenly going to confess everything to her, she wasn't going to make it easy for him.
"Did Harry see me last night? Outside of the motel?"
"I think he did, Jake. What were you doing there?"
"I went to her motel room to keep an eye on her, but I still thought..."
"Who, Jake?"
"Grace's sister. She'd come to identify the body."
"So what?"
"Because she must have known about Bill and his affair with her sister."
"So what?" Alice said again.
"I just wanted to keep an eye on her, Alice. I haven't been able to sleep for days."
"You killed Bill's girlfriend?"
"She was talking with Harry, Alice. She knew something. I know she did."
He sat down on the recliner. Alice's eyes had adjusted to the dark living room, and she saw dust particles rising in the light from the kitchen as Jake settled his weight onto the chair.
"I'm tired, Alice."
"Were you going to kill her, too?" Jake sighed through his nose.
"Who, Caitlin? She was after Harry as well, as it turned out. I was watching her motel and he showed up there. I took off running, but Jesus, I don't know."
"Relax, Jake. Maybe you need to tell me everything you've done."
"If he saw me, then he's probably already told the police. They could be on their way here right now."
"He didn't tell the police anything."
He told Caitlin about me. He'll tell the police.
What do you mean? Did you go see Caitlin?
She was scared of me, Alice. She knew. If she knew, then the police know.
What did you do to her? Alice asked.
I took care of it. She's in the trunk of my car in the garage.
Jesus, Jake, you need...
Don't worry about it. It's all taken care of.
It's not all taken care of. You're right. The police are going to come after you. You need to either leave town or...
Shh, I know what needs to be done. That's why I asked you here, for your help. I know it's a lot to ask, but I need you to do this. I don't think I can do it myself.
I don't know what...
Yes, you do. I'm old and I don't want to go to prison. All you need to do is tell them that I invited you here and when I attacked you, you defended yourself. You can tell them I'd stopped being able to sleep and that I did it all for you. Or just tell them you have no idea what went wrong with me and they'll come up with their own ideas.
It's too warm in here, Jake, Alice said, standing and going to look at the thermostat on the wall.
Do you remember when we first met? Right down there on the beach. You were in a green bathing suit and I'd never seen anyone so beautiful.
You were with my mother.
No, I don't think so. It was just the two of us.
Alice turned from the thermostat to look at Jake. He was wrong about how they'd met, but she did remember meeting him. How strong he looked, how sure of himself he was. He'd lost all that now. Okay, I'll do it, Alice said.
Yes?
How, exactly? Alice walked to the nearest window, the one that looked out over the parking lot. She twisted the lock, noticing the grime that had accumulated on the sill, and cracked the window. The smell of salt air came into the condo almost immediately.
There's a knife in the kitchen, Jake said. I'd get it for you, but I think you should be the one who pulls it from the block. I'll hit you once, very lightly, with the cosh, and then you stab me. There won't be any suspicion, and even if there is, they'll never prove you weren't protecting yourself.
Alice watched as a familiar car, it looked like Harry's green Honda, turned from Scituate onto the condo's parking lot, pulling into an empty spot next to Alice's Volvo. Harry's here, she said, still watching the car.
What?
I'm pretty sure Harry's here, she said, then watched as the driver's side door opened, and it was Harry who stepped out, turning and looking up at the condo building. Alice moved back from the window. It's him. He's here.
Then it has to be done right now.
Okay, I'll do it, Alice said. Where? And suddenly she did want to kill Jake, not as a favor to him, but because she was angry.
In the kitchen.
Jake picked up the sock filled with quarters from the coffee table, and Alice followed him into the alcove.
Tell them we were talking in here. I wasn't making any sense, and I threatened you. You pulled out the knife and protected yourself.
You have to hit me.
I'll hit you lightly. It won't matter.
Jake pointed at the knife block.
Take that one there, top right. It's the sharpest.
The kitchen swam in her vision as Alice walked and gripped the knife's wooden handle, pulling it free from its block. She turned to Jake. There was the loud, echoey bong of the doorbell ringing.
Just do it, Jake said. There's no time now.
Hit me first. Jake nodded and feebly swung the sock with the quarters, glancing them off of Alice's shoulders. It's got to be harder, she said. He swung again, clipping her left ear. It hurt more than she thought it would. She blinked rapidly. The doorbell rang a second time. She punched the knife into his chest, where she thought his heart was, but the knife only went about an inch in, and Jake staggered backward a step, dropping the cosh on the floor. She looked into his eyes, trying to remember the man who had once lifted her into his arms and carried her like a bride into this very home. Now all she saw in his eyes was confusion, and a little bit of panic. He lifted a hand up, his fingers spread, and Alice took hold of his wrist, pressed his hand up against the side of her face, bringing him in closer to her. His fingers gripped her neck, his nails ripping at her skin. They were both breathing heavily, Jake's lips apart, but his stained teeth clenched together. He squeezed harder at Alice's neck, and she felt a trickle of blood run down into her collarbone. She stabbed him again harder, and this time, when she pulled the knife out, blood began to soak his shirt. He dropped to his knees, and then to the ground. Jake put his hand on his chest, and the blood pumped out between his fingers, pooling in the folds of his shirt. The doorbell rang again. Alice watched Jake, just to make sure he'd stopped breathing. She dropped the knife to the floor, where it skittered away, leaving a trail of blood. She touched her fingers to her neck, puffy where the welts were already rising up. "He nearly killed me," she thought. Then, "I had to do it. I had to do it," the words running through her head as she moved, trance-like, to the front door. Chapter 32. Now. Alice's car was outside in the parking lot, so Harry knew she was in the condo. He pressed the doorbell, telling himself that if no one answered, maybe he should just inform the police of what he thought he'd seen. Still, it would be better if he could get one more look at John, just so he could know for sure if he was the one he'd seen in front of the motel. And with Alice here, he had an excuse. He was concerned, looking for his stepmother. He rang the bell again, hoping he had the correct door. He'd picked the unit closest to where Alice's car was parked. An exterior stairway led up to the entryway, above a garage. It was low tide, and the air was filled with the smell of rot. Harry pulled his phone out just as the door swung inward. "Harry," Alice said. Her neck was smeared with blood. "Harry," she said again. "Call the police." He stared at the phone in his hand. How had it gotten there? Then he dialed 911 for the second time in a week. He gave the dispatcher the address, but wasn't able to tell her what had happened. She kept insisting he find out, but he hung up and stepped into the dim condo. Alice had retreated and was now sitting on a white leather sofa, holding her hands out to either side. She looked like she was meditating.
"Where's John?" Harry asked.
"He's in the kitchen, Harry." Harry took another tentative step into the living room. His eyes began to adjust. To his left was a lit alcove kitchen. Harry took another step and looked toward it. He could see the upturned feet of a body lying on the linoleum.
"What happened?"
"He was crazy, Harry. He asked me to come here, and I came, and he wasn't making any sense. He kept telling me how he had to kill all the people who were threatening him, and then he tried to... I had to protect myself. Is he dead, do you think?" Harry forced himself to take two more steps toward the alcove. Recessed fluorescence in the ceiling lit the scene. John was on his back, one hand sprawled in the spreading pool of blood, the other resting gently on his chest. The smell of the blood, like tidal mud, reached Harry's nostrils, and he took three quick steps back out the condo's door and vomited over the railing. In the distance, he heard the sound of sirens. "Is he dead, Harry?" Alice's voice was closer, and Harry's body jerked involuntarily, the way it sometimes did when he was falling asleep and thought he was actually falling. He turned back, wiping at his mouth. Alice was in the doorway, her hands still held out from her body, her palms up.
"He looks dead."
"He killed Bill, you know. He killed your father. He just told me."
"Why did he do it?" Harry asked.
"He didn't make a whole lot of sense, but it was about me. He was protecting me, I think, and that's why he killed the two girls as well."
"What two girls?"
"He said their names, Grace, the girl who was murdered, and then he mentioned another girl. Her sister.
Caitlin's her sister. Where is she? What did he say?
I can't-
What did he say about Caitlin?
Don't yell at me, Harry. He said she was in the trunk of his car.
The sirens were louder.
Where's his car?
Harry asked.
Harry, let the police-
Where is it?
Downstairs, I think, in the garage. Harry, don't leave me.
But he was going down the steps. He reached the garage and pulled up the unlocked door just as the first police cruiser slanted into the parking lot and came to a halt. John's red Audi, nose in, was parked in the dark garage. It looked far too ordinary to contain a body, to contain Caitlin's body. It wasn't possible, Harry thought.
Did you call 911?
An officer was asking him. Harry turned.
There's a body up the stairs from here, in the kitchen. He's dead.
Another uniformed officer was already making her way up the wooden steps.
Is this your car?
The officer again. He was young, with sleepy-looking slanted eyes.
It's not. I think there might be someone in the trunk.
Then Harry turned and said, in a slightly louder tone than his usual talking voice,
Caitlin? You in there?
If I don't open it, he thought, then it's not happening.
Sir,
the officer said, but didn't add anything. His radio squawked, then Harry heard a few muffled words, the policewoman asking him to come upstairs.
Stay right here, okay? I'll be right back.
The policeman looked frozen for a moment, unsure of what to do. Harry nodded and said,
I won't leave.
The policeman made a decision and moved toward the stairs. There was another siren in the distance. Harry pulled the driver's side door, and it swung open. He fumbled along the floor near the bucket seat, finding a lever and pulling it. The trunk made a popping sound, but the lid stayed down. There was no other sound as Harry went back to the rear of the car, grasped the lid in his hand, and lifted it, praying silently to himself. The body was on its side, in the fetal position, facing in. The sharp smell of urine stung at Harry's nose, and he was hit by a wave of dizziness, dark nothingness pinching at his vision. Then he thought he saw the body twitch, shoulders contracting in as though she was cold.
Caitlin,
he said, and shook her shoulder, rolling her onto her back. The bottom half of her face was coated in dried blood. She stared up at him with what looked like lifeless eyes, and then she blinked. Chapter 33. Now. They'd driven through the night, and the sun was now coming up behind them as they glided through flat Canadian farmlands in Paul Roman's Prius. The sky, streaked in pink and orange, was like an enormous bowl. They'd crossed into Canada at Buffalo, skirting north of Lake Erie, the fastest route to get to Ann Arbor, Michigan.
You okay to keep driving?
Harry asked Paul, who was lighting up another cigarette.
You're awake? I've been awake. I haven't slept.
Paul turned up the music, an Alanis Morissette album.
Just while we're in Canada,
and told Harry that he'd be able to drive the rest of the way. They reached the outskirts of Ann Arbor by mid-morning, the sky a deep metallic blue, and picked the first motel that didn't look like it was owned by Norman Bates. They each stood by the car for a few moments after getting out, Paul doing jumping jacks while Harry stretched out his legs. The air was cool and smelled of nothing. They rented a room with two double beds. The woman at the front desk, her sparse white hair combed over a bald pate, suggested they go to the Nichols Arboretum if they wanted a nice activity for later in the day. Paul told her they were attending a funeral mass, and Harry watched as her eyes flicked from Paul's face to his, then quickly back down to the computer. The murders in Kennewick, Maine were national news,
and Harry was sure that they were much bigger news in Ann Arbor, where Grace McGowan's memorial was being held at 3 that afternoon. They each ate an enormous breakfast at a Shoney's, then went back to the motel room to sleep. Paul crawled under his covers fully dressed and said,
"I don't have to go to the service if you don't want me there. I'd be happy to tour Ann Arbor's bar scene instead."
"Oh no, you're coming,"
Harry said. Paul didn't answer. He was asleep already. Harry tried to sleep, but found himself alternately staring at the ceiling and then his phone, hoping to get a text from Caitlin, who knew he was arriving that morning. He hadn't planned on texting her himself. It was the day of her sister's funeral, after all. But he was secretly hoping she might reach out to him, just to acknowledge his arrival, to tell him it was okay he was there, although she'd already given him that blessing. It was 5 days since he'd opened the trunk of Jake Richter's car and thought he was looking at her dead body. The returning policeman had helped Harry lift her from the trunk as an ambulance arrived. She'd started to shiver once his arms touched her, and called his name, her voice barely audible. When she was on the gurney and about to be rolled into the ambulance, she lifted her hand and beckoned to Harry. He came close to her, placing his ear down by her mouth.
"It was John Richards," she whispered.
"I know," Harry said. "He's dead now."
Caitlin was initially brought to Kennewick Hospital, but was moved that evening to Portland and kept under observation for 2 days. Detective Dixon told Harry that her physical issues were comparatively mild, a broken nose, a contused neck, but that she was now under psychiatric care. Harry didn't get a chance to see her before she returned to Michigan. He'd asked several times if he could see her, but was always told that she wasn't seeing any visitors. And then he was informed she was back in Michigan with her family. During those bizarre days after Jake Richter's death, Alice, hounded by the throng of journalists that had arrived in Kennewick Village, had moved into a spare bedroom at her friend Chrissy Herrick's house. Paul Roman had immediately arrived in Kennewick, found an Airbnb near the harbor, and Harry had moved in with him, bringing Lou the cat from the store. He got far more information from Chrissy than he did from Alice, who'd barely spoken since being attacked by Jake in his condominium. Harry tried to elicit more information from Detective Dixon, but he was tight-lipped because of the ongoing investigation. Harry also wondered if Dixon was somehow ashamed at not having arrested Jake earlier. According to the articles that Harry read online, Jake had been a person of interest in the investigation into the murders of Bill Ackerson and Grace McGowan, but the police were convinced that the perpetrators were Lou and Annie Callahan, neither of whom had solid alibis for either murder. Since the events that led to his death, more had come out about Jake Richter's past, including from a schoolteacher from Albany named Joan Johnson, who claimed that Jake Richter, back when he'd been a co-worker of her mother's, had seduced her when she was just a teenager. It also turned out that Jake Richter had lived for a number of years in the Fort Lauderdale area in Florida, where he'd been fired from a job at a beach resort because of inappropriate behavior. A picture emerged of a lifelong sexual predator. There was much speculation that when he'd been married to Alice Moss's mother, he'd been sexually assaulting Alice, and that he'd most likely killed Bill Ackerson out of some form of jealousy. Alice hadn't spoken publicly yet to dismiss any of these rumors, but Vivienne Bergeron, a longtime resident of Kennewick, sold a story to one of the tabloids in which she said she knew for a fact that Jake and Alice had been lovers. But she also said that Alice had murdered her daughter, an erroneous claim she had apparently been making for years. Harry had seen Alice just once since they'd been together in Jake's condo. Chrissy had texted him to ask if he could get some more clothes from Gray Lady, plus Alice's straightening iron, and deliver them to her. A ginormous favor, I know. And Harry had done it, going late at night back to the house to avoid news reporters, although one enterprising journalist had raced from his car when Paul and he emerged from the house with two suitcases filled with Alice's things. They'd refused to answer the reporter's shouted questions, and the next morning Harry went to the Herricks' house. Alice had given him a short hug after he'd brought the suitcases into her bedroom.
"I'll leave you two alone for a while," Chrissy said, and disappeared.
"How are you holding up?"
Harry asked. Alice still held onto one of his hands, then let go and sat on the edge of the bed. Harry sat on a wicker chair that had been painted white.
"I'm in shock, Harry. I'd known Jake my whole life."
"Why was he calling himself John Richards?"
"I asked him once, and he said he just wanted a fresh start. But now, I think he was trying to escape something from his past. Maybe something he did in Florida."
"And you're sure that my father knew he was your stepfather?"
Harry asked.
"Oh, I'm sure he did," Alice said quickly. "Still, it wasn't a big thing. He and my mother were married barely any time at all. I just can't believe. I had no idea he was capable."
"You must have thought it strange that he changed his name."
"It should have concerned me more, I know, but..."
"I just wondered,"
Harry said. It was bothering him, not so much that Jake was calling himself by a different name, but that Alice had gone along with it. He wondered if his father really knew who his employee was, but there was no way to find that out now. They spoke for just a little bit longer, Harry trying to read Alice's emotions, her thoughts, but it was something he'd never been able to do, and he still couldn't.
"I should go," he said.
"Where are you going next?" Alice asked.
"Paul rented a place near here, and I'm staying with him."
"No, I mean, after all this is over, will you stay here in Maine?"
"I don't think so, Alice."
"No, I know. I understand."
"How about you?"
"I'll stay here. I don't know where else I'd go."
They hugged goodbye, and Alice held onto Harry a little too long, her face buried in his neck, as though she was smelling him.
"Jake probably killed my mother," she said, as soon as they'd broken the embrace.
"What do you mean?"
Harry asked.
"He probably killed my mother. She died of an overdose when I was in high school."
"Did you tell the police?"
"I told them everything, but there's nothing they can do about it now."
He walked back to his car, feeling as though he might never see her again. Harry spotted Caitlin at the funeral mass before she saw him. He and Paul had arrived very early to St. Julia's, a pretty stone church with a circular stained glass window, and had taken a seat far at the back. The church was quiet, a few guests filtering in, whispering among themselves. The music began. Harry recognized it as Schubert's Ave Maria, and a few minutes later, there was Caitlin, dressed in black, walking down the aisle on one side of a woman who was clearly her mother. On the other side was a tall, gangly boy, probably a brother. They walked toward the front of the church. A minute or so later, a lone, middle-aged man came down the aisle. Tears streaked his face, and Harry thought that was probably the estranged father. He sat in the second row, alone. Music continued to play as the church filled. Paul and Harry had to slide down their pew to allow room for late arrivals. When the mass began, several people were standing toward the rear of the church. Harry had never been to a Catholic funeral before, and he found it disconcertingly formal but comforting, as though the rote prayers and the familiar hymns connected Grace's death to all the other deaths within her faith. Paul went up to receive communion, but Harry stayed put, suddenly wishing he hadn't come. He felt a little like an imposter. He'd barely known Grace, and he barely knew Caitlin. Why was he here? After the service, Grace's body was carried out of the church, accompanied by a modern-sounding hymn about being raised up on eagle's wings. something about the corny song and the slow procession of mourners, and Harry was crying, Paul's arm around him. They were among the last to leave the church. The family had already departed, and several groups of young people lingered outside. Cigarette smoke wafted through the air.
Bar, Harry said to Paul. You don't want to go to the reception?
Not really.
Bar it is.
They walked into downtown Ann Arbor, a wide street flanked by square brick buildings and numerous college bars, and picked a place called the Library that turned out to be much more of a sports bar than its name implied. They each got a shot of Jameson and a Guinness, Paul saying there was no other drink choice after a Catholic funeral, then loaded the jukebox with as much 1980s music as they could find, and claimed a booth next to a big Buck Hunter video game. Harry checked his phone.
I'm not complaining, Paul said, but we came a long way for this. Are you not planning on trying to see her?
I don't know. I didn't just come for her. I came to go to the funeral, and we've done that.
Okay, then. It's your call.
They stayed a couple of hours as the place filled up. Paul got a lesson from a group of fraternity brothers on how to play Big Buck Hunter and ended up, as usual, with a bunch of new best friends. Three rounds in, Harry was drunk enough to text Caitlin, saying how he'd been to the funeral and wished he'd had a chance to say hello. To his surprise, she texted back right away. I thought I saw you at the back. Come to Kildare's pub tonight, if you're up for it. It's a gathering of all our high school friends. I'll be there at 9, but can't promise I'll stay for more than one drink. Harry wrote that he'd be there, and he told Paul to make him go, no matter what. They left the library at dusk and went back to the motel and changed. Then they walked back toward downtown, getting dinner at a family-run Italian restaurant. They made it to Kildare's at just around 9:30. It was a typical faux Irish pub, dark red walls, unvarnished wood floor, the Dropkick Murphys playing on the speakers. There was a separate alcove on the opposite side of the bar, and it was crammed with young people, some still in funeral wear, suits and black dresses. Harry's stomach hurt at the thought of navigating his way into the crowd to try to find Caitlin, but he knew he should do it. He went with Paul to the bar for a beer, and just before he was about to order, saw Caitlin, in jeans and a black sweater, come out from the crowd, scanning the room. She spotted Harry and came right over.
You came, she said, and something about the way she was standing stopped Harry from trying to hug her.
I did. This is my friend Paul Roman.
Paul turned from the bar and took Caitlin's hand in his, leaning in and saying something Harry couldn't hear over the music. Caitlin smiled, showing a lot of gum.
I'm leaving, actually, Caitlin said. Harry, can you walk me home?
Chapter 34. Now. They walked past a succession of crowded bars and restaurants, then hooked left onto a residential side street.
It's about 2 miles. You sure you don't mind?
Not at all.
I couldn't stand being there. Everyone's saying all the right things, but it still just feels like life is going on without her. Which it is.
The funeral mass was nice. I'd never been to one.
Caitlin's phone was buzzing, and she stopped, apologized, then rapidly texted to someone on her phone. My friend who brought me to the bar is freaking out that I left. She texted some more, then put the phone away. They kept walking.
Tell me what happened between your stepmother and Jake Richter, she said. I know what the police told me, but that's it. She stabbed him before you got there?
Harry told her everything that had happened after he'd been admitted to the hospital. He told her about waking up and thinking that the man he'd seen outside of the motel was John Richards, and how Alice told him that John had once been her stepfather. He told her about going home and using Phone Finder on his phone to learn that Alice was at John's house, and deciding that he needed to see him one more time, just to be sure. He told her in detail what Alice had looked like, the blood on her neck, that he'd seen Jake dead in the kitchen, and that before the police came, Alice told him Jake had said Caitlin was in the trunk of the car. "You must have thought I was dead," she said.
"I did. And then when I opened the trunk, you were just laying there, not moving at all."
"I told myself to pretend I was dead, to just be still. For some reason, even though I knew it was you in the garage, I couldn't make myself move."
"Why didn't he kill you, do you think?"
Harry asked. "He came to the motel to find out if you knew it was him, I think. That's what he was asking me anyway, and when I didn't tell him anything, he hit me again and put me in the trunk of his car. I remember that he was gentle, and some part of me was thankful."
"I think he was insane,"
Harry said.
"You think?"
Harry laughed.
"He didn't say anything?"
"He did. He said something about being tired after he put me in the trunk, and then he took a tie from his jacket pocket and he rolled me onto my side and bound my hands together. And I let him do it."
"You'd been knocked out, right?"
"Not really. A little. He'd hit me twice and my nose was broken. I could have fought back, but I didn't."
"Maybe that was the smart move. Maybe if you'd fought back, then he would have killed you."
"I know. That's what everyone tells me. But I still can't stop thinking about it. I just gave up. I think I was telling myself that it was my best chance, that he had somehow changed his mind about killing me, and I didn't want to do anything that would make him change his mind again."
"It was a good instinct."
"After he shut the trunk, he drove back to his house, I guess. I could tell he parked in a garage by the way the engine sounded in there, and then I heard him pulling down the garage door. I thought he was just going to let me die in there. I didn't move. I didn't even try to see if there was a way out of the trunk, a release lever or something."
"There probably wasn't,"
Harry said.
"His car was pretty old."
"It's not that. Sorry, I know. You're right. I still wish I'd tried. I just lay there, praying that the next person who came along wasn't him, and then my prayer came true. It was you."
"Do you remember telling me his name? That it was John Richards who did that to you? You could barely talk."
"I do remember that. Of course, it wasn't his real name." She shivered a little, even though it was still pretty warm out, the sky purple-hued and filled with stars.
"It was the name he was going by, and it was a smart thing to do,"
Harry said.
"Remembering his name, telling me right away."
"Do you keep thinking about it?" she asked.
"Oh, yeah,"
Harry said.
"Every minute of every day, it's a loop in my head. What he did to my father and to your sister and then to you."
"What he almost did to me."
"Yeah, I think about that as well. He could have killed you, then killed my stepmother."
"He could have killed you."
"He could have, yes."
They were quiet for a few steps. They'd taken several turns, and the houses were now larger and spread farther apart. "It's not far now," Caitlin said. "This was good. I needed to talk about what happened with someone who was there. Everyone keeps tiptoeing around me."
"They're just worried."
"I know they are." They turned again, down a street lined with tall trees, their leaves bristling in the light breeze. "I'm right down here," Caitlin said, and pointed toward a white colonial, lights on in all the windows. "Wanna walk around the block? I don't wanna stop talking."
"Okay."
As they walked, Caitlin asked Harry about his plans, and he told her he didn't have any, except that he wasn't going to stay in Maine. "Will your stepmother be upset?"
"I'm sure, but I can't go back to living with her. I feel for her because of what she went through, but there's still a part of me. It's hard to explain, but I don't entirely trust her. I feel like there's more to the story between her and Jake than I'll ever know."
"You think she was in on it?"
"No, not really. I don't know."
When they reached the front of Caitlin's house again, Caitlin said, "Can I ask a favor?"
"Sure, anything."
"Will you come in and spend the night?
Not with me, but there's a guest room you can sleep in.
Harry hesitated, but Caitlin's eyes, dark in the moonlight, were large with fear and anticipation, and he said,
"Of course."
Inside, she introduced him to her mother, who was standing in the kitchen, wearing a robe and drinking a cup of tea.
"Oh, Harry," she said, "I'm so sorry about your father."
She looked like both of her daughters, but more like Grace, Harry thought, with her firm jawline and upturned nose. She had kind eyes. Harry told her how sorry he was about Grace, about how much he'd liked her in the short time he had known her.
"She was troubled, but she'd have turned it around. I know it."
"She would have, Mom," Caitlin said, and rolled her eyes slightly so that only Harry could see. The guest room was on the second floor. Caitlin, suddenly hostess-like, showed him where the spare blankets were in the closet and brought him a pair of pajamas that belonged to her brother, plus an unused toothbrush.
"Pajamas are clean, I promise," she said.
"This is weird, me wanting you to stay here, isn't it?"
"No, it really isn't."
"When do you think we'll feel normal again?"
"I don't know,"
Harry said.
"I don't know if we'll ever feel normal, but I think we'll feel better."
Caitlin shut the door of the guest room almost all the way closed and kissed him. Her sweater was thin cashmere, and he could feel her ribs through the fabric, her heartbeat, the ridge of a bra strap. They kept kissing until there were footsteps on the stairs, and Caitlin opened the door wider, stepped out into the hall, and said to Harry,
"Breakfast will be at the crack of dawn, unfortunately."
"I heard that," Mrs. McGowan said from the hall.
"Perfect," Harry said.
After she left, he changed into the pajamas, texted Paul to let him know where he was, and slid into the unfamiliar bed. After turning the lamp off, he thought, "There's no way I'll ever fall asleep here." But then the next thing he knew, there was faint light coming through the curtains on the window, and he could smell bacon being cooked. He sat up a little in bed and listened to the sounds of the house coming alive. He had slept through the entire night, a dreamless abyss of sleep. It was definitely strange that he was suddenly here, in Caitlin's childhood home, but it was no stranger than anywhere else he might be right now. He had no real home. He was about to get out of bed when his phone on the bedside table began to vibrate. He checked the screen. It was a Kennewick number.
"Harry, it's Detective Dixon. Sorry to bother you so early."
"It's okay. What's happened?"
"I was wondering if you knew where your stepmother was."
"Is she missing?"
"She is, actually."
"I don't know where she is. I'm actually not in Maine right now."
"What do you mean she's missing?"
"Well, she never came home to her friend's house last night, and no one can find her. Her car's at Jake Richter's condo, but she's not there."
"I'm sorry, I have no idea where she might be."
"We'll keep looking. I'm sure she's fine, but call me if you hear from her, okay, Harry?"
Harry promised he would, and ended the call. The mention of Alice jarred loose a dream he'd had the night before last. Alice, naked, in the window of Grain Lady, Harry watching from the driveway. She was tapping on the glass, but it wasn't making any sound. His father was there as well, changing a tire on his old Volvo, not paying a whole lot of attention to anyone. The house was stirring and the dream disappeared. Harry sat for a moment longer in the bed, knowing, somehow instinctively and with complete certainty, that Alice, despite what Detective Dixon had just said, was not going to be fine. Chapter 35. Then and Now. Once Alice went back to her bedroom, after Jake had told her he'd seen her return from the beach that night Gina drowned, she knew she'd never sleep with Jake again. That part of her life, the part with Jake, was over. Life was restarts, one after another, and some were good and some weren't. Her life had first restarted when her mother got the settlement money and they moved to Kennewick. It started again when Jake arrived, standing over her on the beach, and she could feel the way he was looking at her. It even restarted after Scott Morgan told everyone at school she was a slut, and she decided it didn't matter, that whatever they said couldn't touch her. And now she would have to start again, because Jake thought she'd had something to do with killing her own mother or letting Gina drown when both those things had happened accidentally. They'd happened to her, not because of her. Jake, in the days following, tried only once to get Alice back. She was in her room, the door closed, rereading Tender Rebel, a dumb romance novel she'd read many, many times. Jake knocked, then half-entered, standing in the doorframe.
"What are you doing?"
he asked. She held the book up. "Reading?"
"Thought you might like to read a little in bed with me. It's lonely in there."
"I'm fine here, Jake."
"Okay,"
he said.
"Just checking."
She remembered what he'd been like immediately after her mother's funeral, the way he'd taken control of her. He'd become a different man now that she didn't love him or trust him anymore. Her indifference gave her the upper hand, a fact she decided to file away. "Jake," she said, as he was departing.
"Yeah?"
he said, a hopeful look on his face. "I'm going to look for a new job and a new apartment."
"Oh."
"I thought I'd let you know in advance." She gave her notice at Blethyn's Apothecary and got a job as an office assistant at a real estate company. She stopped taking classes since she was working full-time and rented a one-bedroom apartment in a stucco building not far from the real estate office. It was quiet in the apartment, and she liked it. She made simple meals and watched television, and on the weekends she'd go swimming at the Y. Coast Home Realty Crew, relocating to a new, larger office in a strip mall off Route 1A. Alice coordinated the move, even working with Caroline, the big boss, to design the new office, and when the company was firmly established in their new, plush surroundings, Caroline asked Alice if she ever thought about getting her real estate license. "I hate to lose you as our office manager, but you'd be a good agent. I just know it." Alice had never really considered this, partly because the real estate agents, at least the ones who made the most sales, all seemed to have big, vibrant personalities. Alice told Caroline that she didn't think so, but Caroline insisted. "You're the hardest worker I've ever had in here. It just seems a shame that we can't get you making some fat commissions." So Alice got her license, and 2 months later sold her first property, a starter home for a young couple, both school teachers, who had moved down from Orono. She celebrated by getting a larger apartment and a new car. She began to spend more time with Chrissy Herrick, another realtor at the agency, who'd gotten her license when her second kid began grade school. Chrissy, a talker, reminded Alice of Gina, but a Gina that had life all figured out. She was happily married to a dull and faithful man, and was basically content with her lot. Chrissy's favorite activity was telling Alice how pretty she was and how she wanted to set her up with some nice man. Alice let her have her way just once, more out of curiosity than anything else, and Chrissy and her husband, plus Alice and a local divorcee who worked in Portland in insurance, all went out to dinner. At the end of the interminable night, the divorcee walked Alice to her car, one hand on the small of her back, his thumb making circular motions. She imagined sinking her teeth into that thumb, the surprised look on his piggy face when the blood began to flow. But she didn't do it, just quickly slid into her car, shutting the door and cracking the window enough to thank him for the evening. That night she lay in bed, ignoring the ringing phone in her house that could only be Chrissy hoping for an update, and slid gradually into sleep, wondering if her life would ever start again. Then she met Bill Ackerson,
a suave New Yorker looking to relocate to Maine and open a bookstore. She knew he was attracted to her, and she thought he seemed to be a nice man, but decided she wasn't interested. When he next contacted her, he asked if she'd mind if he brought his